Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Let me give you a little preview of what I will be covering on election night and then dig into one of those things right now as a heads up of something you might want to watch for. At 7 o'clock on Tuesday night, I'll be hosting the first hour of our national election night coverage produced by us here at WNYC. It'll be a national call-in plus early results. One of the states we might know something meaningful about in that early hour is North Carolina, where the polls close at 7:30 and where I am told they will already have counted the early votes and be able to release those numbers. Not every state does it that way. But North Carolina was one of those Obama, then Trump states. So if Joe Biden carries North Carolina and that result is easy enough to call early on, that could be a huge bellwether early in the night for a possible blowout. That, of course, is only one scenario, but it makes North Carolina in the early hours, even the early minutes of election night, really interesting to watch. We'll drill down on North Carolina here in just a minute. Then, for the record, at 8 o'clock, we'll turn to the national coverage. We'll turn the national coverage over to NPR, and I will anchor our local results in that 8 o'clock hour just for our local listeners here in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. Then at 9 o'clock Tuesday night, and this might be fun for some of you, I'll be a guest with On the Media's Election Night special on Zoom. Maybe I'll have to put on my election night on camera best. You know, it's really funny doing TV or Zoom appearances from home during COVID. It makes sense when you're going out to an event to put on a suit, a tie, or whatever, right? But when I'm sitting here just off the kitchen in full view of my trash and recycling bins, it's so weird to get dressed up. It's one of the lesser weirdnesses of this era, but strange nonetheless. Anyway, I think this one will be pretty informal, but I'll be joining On the Media's Zoom special at 9 o'clock with Brooke Gladstone for about 20 minutes. And then I'll sit around at home and have a lot of media streams going and bite my nails with the rest of you. So just for the record on where you can find me on the radio and on Zoom on election night. So, North Carolina. A New York Times Siena College poll out today finds that two-thirds of likely voters in the state have already cast ballots and that Biden has about a three-point lead. The lead line of that story calls Biden's lead small but durable. We'll find out how durable. I'm sure 3 points is within the margin of error, so small means small, but it's a big state to watch. Let's take a closer look. Joining us now is Elena Schneider, national political reporter at Politico and a North Carolina native. One of her articles last week was called Booming Suburbs Boost Biden in North Carolina. Hi, Elena. Thanks for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Would you give us some recent history to start out? Like, this is a southern state that Obama won in 2008, but lost in 2012, I believe. Why did he win and why didn't they want to reelect him?
So you're right. I mean, North Carolina for a long time was seen as a solidly red state. And in 2008, Barack Obama did something pretty unbelievable at the time, which was turn it blue. And he was able to do that in 2008 by cobbling together a coalition of youngsters, turning out young voters at rates people hadn't seen in a decade, increasing and exciting the African-American vote in the state, which is critical for Democrat to win statewide, and then peeling off just as college-educated, particularly white women in 2008 to get very North Carolina. He also had pretty famously an enormous GOTV, so mobilization canvassing effort to go door-to-door to get people out to vote in North Carolina, long before John McCain even thought that North Carolina was competitive. But as you note, he wasn't able to win it again. In 2012, he lost that state to Mitt Romney and wasn't able to pull it off. And no Democrat, at least on the presidential level, has been able to pull it off since. And it's a really fascinating state, though, where you know, even though back in 2008, nobody's been able to repeat that victory, it's one that's gotten increasingly more diverse. It's gotten bigger. About 1 million people have moved to North Carolina, particularly sort of those booming suburbs around Raleigh, around Charlotte, around my hometown of Winston-Salem, where, you know, there are tech jobs, where there are banking jobs. And that's brought in a lot of newcomers and a lot of young people and a lot of those college-educated voters that we've talked so much about this cycle.
Fair number of people from the New York area moving down to the Research Triangle area, Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill. I personally have family from Long Island. I know other Long Islanders who've moved down there, other people. So it's a big place for New Yorkers.
Those are my parents. They moved from New York City. I was born in New York for about 6 months there and then moved down to North Carolina. So yeah, my family is part of that move too.
There you go. So listeners, help us out with this. Our phones are open if you are in or have a connection to or have a question about the key swing state of North Carolina, 646-435-7280, or tweet a question at Brian Lehrer. If you're there or you're from there, why is your state so close? How do you see the end game? Or anyone, what do you want to ask? Politico's Elena Schneider, 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280. You point out in your piece that Obama lost white college-educated voters by 20 points in 2008, but Biden now holds a hefty lead among white college-educated voters in the polls. Who are those people, and where did they live? Why are they switching?
So I think those are the sorts of people we were just talking about, those young people, those young families who have moved into North Carolina because of jobs, particularly in Wake and Mecklenburg County. These are two urban suburban counties where, like I said, Raleigh and Charlotte, you know, play home to Raleigh and Charlotte. And that's where we've seen enormous growth in North Carolina. And simultaneous with that, I mean, North Carolina in a lot of ways is very much representative of the experience or the regionalization of politics and the polarization of those regions, where the urban suburban areas are progressively have grown bluer and bluer cycle over cycle in the last decade, while the rural areas have become redder and redder. And that's really what we're going to continue to see. If Trump is able to hold on in North Carolina in 2020, it'll be because he performs really well in those rural counties. The problem for Trump, though, is that that's where the population loss has been seen, or in those rural counties. And Biden can really lean on this growth in the suburbs that we talked about. And, you know, in comparing sort of what Obama was able to do in 2008 and how he was able to stitch together that coalition, you know, Biden is repeating some of that. Certainly African-American voters are still hugely important and critical to Biden winning there. And in fact, you can see that, you know, evidenced in these trips that both Kamala Harris and Joe Biden have taken to the state. It's almost exclusively focused on Black mobilization events to North Carolina. So they know that that piece of the coalition is still critical, but their coalition is a little bit older and a little bit whiter than Obama's. You know, like I said, he's going to be able to peel off a significant chunk of those college-educated voters that Obama was starting to get a little bit of in 2008, sort of able to hold down the margins there. Mm-hmm. But now Biden has the picture's totally flipped. And so he's now going to be able to pull in all of that. And that may be enough to get him over the top in North Carolina.
And on Black voters, you cite a stat in your article that estimates that Black voters account for about 22% of the early votes that have been validated. How would that compare as a percentage of the vote to 2016, if you happen to know?
You know, I unfortunately, this is a problem of covering so many states, is you've got a lot of percentages floating around in your head. I think that this story is about a week old, and I think that it's basically about still at those levels in terms of early voting. North Carolina is a state where you can declare your, you know, the demographics, and so we have at least a little bit of a sense of the racial makeup of what's been returned. I think in North Carolina in 2016, it was a tick or two below that, and in Obama's case in 2008, he was able to get it to about 23%.
You know what,
so again,
Elena,
we're dealing with very, very small pages. Here's that big, right. A huge difference.
Hang on a second. We're going to put you on hold, and we're going to try to clear up your line, get you on a better line, perhaps, because you're breaking up a little bit here and there. I want it to be as clear as possible for everybody listening right now. So as we continue with Elena Schneider from Politico, we'll start going to some of your many calls. Yes, there are a lot of connections between Greater New York and Greater North Carolina. So Ron in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hey, Ron, thanks for calling in.
Yeah, my little brother lives in North Carolina. He's been down there a considerable amount of time. He's from the Army, and he got out of the Army, and he got a job down there. And he's got a six-bedroom home for $200,000.
Ah, that's a different world.
I know. He's from the Bronx. He lives well. He just bought a Mercedes. So the cost of living is a factor, and it's just much better living down in that as crowded and congested as New York is. And also, if the Democrats get in, the stimulus money is guaranteed. So a lot of people who are Republicans who need that stimulus money are going to vote Democratic. They might as well, because once Biden gets in and the Senate is Democratic and the Congress is Democratic, they're going to pass the right. $600 a week for unemployment and all the things that Pelosi wants. Yeah, so everybody's going to vote Democratic for the money. That's another motivating factor.
Because a lot of people in North Carolina, like in New York, are suffering economically because of the pandemic. And it's true in a lot of states. Ron, thank you so much for that. Larry in Port Washington, you're on WNYC. Hello, Larry.
Hi, Brian. I just wanted to tell you that I'm a New Yorker, raised, been here all my adult life. I have a younger brother who moved to North Carolina and is a very successful businessman. And we had a big fight at my kid brother's daughter's wedding about 4 years ago, just before the election. And he's very conservative, and I know he listens to a lot of conservative talk radio. But the other day, he texted me in the morning, did you vote yet? And I just, LOL, what a weird random text. And we ended up chatting about other family issues, and he wanted to tell me that he voted for Biden.
Uh-huh.
Early voted for Biden in North Carolina.
What flipped your brother?
Well, he just knows that Trump is a crank. He's a phony. He's a con man. And of course, we who live here in New York and have known that for many, many, many years. So, and I just thought it was really interesting that he wanted me to know. He wanted me to know that because we did. I mean, I remember at the wedding reception we had this. It got heated, and I had to walk away, and I waved my hand at him, and he got angry, and I was angry, and now I'm getting all these wonderful texts from him. So it's like he's...
It's a wonderful story to hear, because we hear so many stories about family estrangement in the Trump era, and you're telling us a story of family reconciliation in the Trump era around this Biden.
I think so.
Around this Biden versus Trump election. And Elena Schneider from Politico, who's back with us. Who knows? Maybe that'll be the national story after the election. The polarization will flip to a new era of reconciliation. It's probably way too gauzy and, you know, Pollyanna-ish of you, but it's what Biden says he hopes to do. Maybe it'll happen in North Carolina. Maybe it'll happen elsewhere. Elena, do we have you back?
You do. And look, I think that that's certainly what Biden hopes to communicate. It's a message that he has held to since he launched his campaign. That has been his message, is the, you know, restoring the soul of the nation. And like you said, some people see that as maybe a little Pollyanna in this era, but I think that that's certainly his goal. And I think that that's also part of what has appealed to people, both in this primary and in this general election, is the sense of sort of a return to normalcy. And even though, like you said, we may not get there, at least the goal of getting there is one that I think is certainly very appealing to people.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Elena Schneider, national political correspondent for Politico, who's from North Carolina and has reported on North Carolina, a very key swing state whose results we might know early on election night. Their polls close at 7:30. And they do count the early ballots early. The early votes can be reported in that first hour on election night. The Republican convention was originally supposed to be in Charlotte. Then in the summer, Trump made a big show of moving it to Florida to get around the large gathering restrictions that North Carolina had in place, like a lot of other states, to lessen the spread of coronavirus. He took a big whack at the governor, Democrat Roy Cooper, for that. Then the virus spiked in Florida as well, and Trump had to cancel that too, and came slinking back to Charlotte with just a few events there to stay within the law. I'm curious, Elena, if that drama itself, including Trump publicly denouncing the safety limits imposed by both the city of Charlotte and the state, have a political effect that you could observe one way or the other.
Well, I think his handling of the coronavirus pandemic writ large has been what is driving, his loss of support, particularly in those suburbs, particularly with those college-educated voters. And in North Carolina in particular, I don't think that his response to the RNC convention was helpful. Look, Democrat Roy Cooper, who won in 2016, it was one of the few Democratic bright spots that year. He eked out a victory over Republican Pat McCrory. And Cooper's really been praised for his handling of the coronavirus pandemic. In fact, he's pretty easily riding to re-election because of the way that he's handled this crisis. And I think the comparison between the two certainly does not help Trump. And it also just more broadly, again, his sort of dismissal of these safety concerns and being sort of a responsible example to people both in North Carolina and nationally is something that remains a major concern for voters. And as much as Trump would like to sort of change the topic and not keep talking about COVID, as he said regularly on the trail in the last few weeks, that's ultimately the issue that is still dominating voters' lives.
Let's take another caller. Pat in Asheville, North Carolina, all the way west in the foothills of the mountains there, right, Pat, near the Tennessee border?
Oh, yeah, it's just so beautiful here. I am from West Milford, very northern bear country in New Jersey.
Uh-huh.
So my daughter's here with AmeriCorps, and I came to see her in March when we had some trouble up in New York area, and I ended up staying here.
Uh-huh.
So I've been here for like the past 7 months, and Asheville is very left-leaning, and but once you step foot outside of the Asheville border and you get into the mountains, you see more, Trump signs. And I have done some activism with Reverend Barber's Poor People campaign. And we went into Hendersonville. And, we had gotten there, and within minutes, I mean, we might have been there. We did a car ride through the town three times around the block in front of Tom Tillis's office. And within 15, 20 minutes, people started coming out with their Trump trucks and their horns. And we had already done what we came to do, so we were gone. But they were pretty active. Lots of trucks, flags flying around. Pretty loud, yeah. Pickup trucks with Trump flags.
Right, but including in
the walk around the neighborhood, Biden signs are everywhere.
Pat, so interesting. I think that's America writ small in a certain way. If you're in town, in the case of Asheville, in the cities, you're going to see a lot of Biden signs. You go outside, the further out you go, you're going to see more Trump signs. Elena, Pat mentioned the presence of the trucks in the streets making noise. And I saw this morning on the website of WRAL-TV in Raleigh that Raleigh police have been going door to door warning downtown businesses and neighboring areas about potential protests expected in the area tonight. I'm curious if you're in touch enough to know what we might expect to see in the streets around these election days from any political side in North Carolina.
Well, I think you're certainly putting your finger on a fear that, election officials, county clerks, people who are going to be running these polling stations, that express real concern about and have been in touch with, in our reporting, in touch with law enforcement about how to handle potential
voter intimidation should that happen on Tuesday, and then obviously preparing for potential protests after the election, should it not go, the way that, whoever shows up doesn't like. And look, this has been a summer in which protests have really defined our experience, even during a pandemic. And I think that there is, again, this expectation that we may see some sort of reaction based on the election results, particularly if they are close. And there's a sense that, in certain states that, that people want to make sure their ballots are counted or feel like something untoward is happening, even though based on all of our reporting, that's not necessarily expected. But again, I mean, this is a really sort of tenuous moment, and one that I think everyone is on high alert and is trying to prepare for.
Also joining us for a few minutes is Daniel Valdez, North Carolina coordinator for the Hispanic Federation, engaged in a Get Out the Vote effort among Latinx people in North Carolina. Hey, Daniel, thanks for coming on with us. Hello from New York.
Hey, good morning, Brian. Thanks for having us.
Write your own story. What's your headline?
Yeah, well, the Latino vote here in North Carolina is going to be very, very important. Latinos, make up for 4.4% of the electorate, and it's only growing every election cycle. And just to give you some reference, in 2016, the election was won by less than 4% of the vote. So I think that there's a lot of enthusiasm in the Latino community, and we've seen that with the record voters that have been out there during early voting.
Elena's article on Politico the other day refers to Democrats saying that there's a big Republican effort to suppress the black vote in North Carolina. Do you see the same thing happening with respect to the Latinx vote?
Yeah, there's been a lot of groups on the ground here that are working to make sure that Latinos in North Carolina understand what the election process is like and get information out to communities. And so we definitely see that there is less knowledge about particularly early voting and mail-in voting process here in North Carolina with the Latino community as it relates to other groups. And so there's a lot of local nonprofits around, including the Hispanic Federation, making sure that Latinos are aware and understand how they can register to vote and actually go out and vote.
How hard is your Get Out the Vote effort turning out to be so far, to the extent that you can gauge it? And in comparison to other years, Jorge Ramos from Univision has a op-ed in the Times today, New York Times, about how Democrats can get over Latinos' lack of enthusiasm for the party. So how much lack of enthusiasm do you see? Because it is, people called Obama the deporter in chief in those days and all of this stuff. So how much lack of enthusiasm do you see compared to 2016, and how are you working around it?
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, we're able to see the votes that are coming in by party and by demographics, those kinds of things. And so Latinos in North Carolina, as of yesterday, over 88,000 Latinos have voted. But this is compared to 45,000 from this time last year, this time in 2016. So we're seeing a huge uptick in the Latino vote for sure. And so I think that we are well in line to break the record that was set back in 2016 by Latinos with 180,000 voters. We're expecting well over 200,000 Latinos to vote in North Carolina this year.
Daniel Valdez, North Carolina coordinator for the Hispanic Federation. Thanks for giving us a few minutes.
No, thank you.
And Elena Schneider from Politico, anything you want to react to in that little conversation?
Certainly. I think that he makes a great point about the growth of the Latino community in North Carolina, and he's right. That's a growing coalition that could present, just as many opportunities for Democrats, but also some challenges. Look, Trump has had some success with Latino men in public polling, and that's certainly an area of concern for Democrats. But more broadly to your point about sort of the get out the vote effort or mobilizing people to actually participate, educating them how to vote. When I talk to Democratic state legislators about in North Carolina about their concerns about what keeps them up at night, a lot of them talked about how they are not able to do the sort of in-person door-to-door canvassing that they were able to do in 2008. And that's part of their very real concern is that they because there is no in-person effort, that there may not be as much participation. Because, look, voting is something that, you know, takes a lot of steps, requires a lot of steps of somebody to show up or cast their ballot or mail it in. And some of that in-person canvassing can help that process along. And Republicans, in contrast, even though there's a pandemic going on, have chosen to do in-person canvassing to make sure that they're getting their voters out to the polls. So when I've talked to Democrats on the ground there, that is something that they cite that they are a little bit worried about.
What are these voter suppression efforts that you referred to in your article aimed at Black North Carolinians?
You know, I think that this is a long-term challenge for North Carolina. You know, I spoke with one of the state house leaders, Leader Reeves, about who is Black himself, and talked about, you know, the experiences that Black voters had had to deal with, be it, limiting the number of poll stations in certain, you know, Black neighborhoods, or not seeing those be as well staffed or well equipped. But these issues have receded a little bit. If they've helped somewhat by having a Democratic governor. Ultimately, there's still full control in the Republican legislature in North Carolina, but by having Governor Cooper there, he's presented a little bit of a check in terms of, pushing back on some of those efforts. And they've also had, Democrats have had some victories in the court systems in North Carolina, where returning ballots, you know, they've extended it by a number of days. So if your ballot, mail-in ballot shows up after Election Day, as long as it's postmarked by that day, then it can still be counted, which is something Republicans were pushing against. So it's a little bit less, it's not to say that it doesn't happen, it's not to say it's not important there, but in some ways a little bit less pronounced than in places like Georgia.
Even
places like Texas.
Lori in Raleigh, you're on WNYC. Hello from New York, Lori. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Brian. I'm so happy to speak to you, even though I am here in Raleigh, North Carolina. I think the last time I called to the show, my goodness, I think it was 2012, and I was actually opening a charter school, and you had an educator on your show that day, and I called in.
Do you live down there now?
Yes. 44 years. I'm born and raised from Queens and lived in Long Island in Nassau County for 15 years, and I've been here in Raleigh for now 4 years.
Well, I'm so glad you're still listening and that you called in again. Yes. So what are you seeing?
And a proud sustaining member. Let me get that out too.
Thank you so much. So what's happening?
And so I will say that where I live in Raleigh, I'm in the very, very north end of Raleigh before it becomes a town called Wake Forest. And so I'm about 50 minutes from the Virginia border. And so in this area, amazingly, when I moved here, didn't know it, I slowly started to find all the New Yorkers. And a lot of New Yorkers from Long Island. And in this area, I would say pretty affluent area, it's kind of, you would feel that it's pretty liberal-leaning, and then as you're taking a walk, you would, like, all of a sudden see someone walk past with a MAGA cap, and your eyes would pop out of your head like the emoji, and you're kind of like, huh? And then you realize, like, oh, you know, it's not what you've seen, or that, you know, it's not as liberal-leaning, or it is, but there are still little mixtures of, you know, other ideologies here. I will say, I voted back the very first week of October. I requested my ballot, first time ever. You know, back in New York City, I always went to the elementary school back in, you know, Southeast Queens, and the elementary school around the corner from my house in Baldwin, Long Island. And so for the first time, here I am with a ballot. And so it came, and I was able to fill it out, and it didn't have the extra envelope, which I thought was great, which everyone complained about. You have to sign it and then put it in another envelope, and then none of that. Yep. And then I simply put it in the mailbox, and literally I was having it tracked by a system that the election board here was using called Ballot Tracks. And I was able to see when the postman got it. It said the postman has your ballot. Then I got another email to let me know when it got to the election board, and it says it's been received. And then I got another email saying your ballot's been accepted. And all within, I put it in the mailbox, I think, on a Friday, and it was accepted by that following Tuesday, Wednesday.
So then you exhaled.
Seamless.
Then you exhaled.
Absolutely.
Lori, thank you so much for the story, and keep calling us. Don't let it be another 8 years. So Elena Schneider from Politico, help me get ready to anchor this first hour of national coverage on Tuesday night. The polls close in North Carolina at 7:30, and how will they announce the results of votes like Lori's that have come in by mail or other early votes that have been received by Election Day?
Well, so to Lori's story, I mean, I think it's important to note, too, that more than 1.4 million voters in North Carolina requested a mail-in ballot, and that's more than six times as many who did it in 2016. And only about 800,000 as of yesterday have actually been returned so far. And when you're asking about what we might see, that, you know, as soon as those polls are closed, those mail-in ballots and whether or not we see the rest of those 800,000 returned are going to be key to our understanding of what North Carolina looks like. I mean, look, Democrats are going to have expected to have a huge lead in mail-in ballots. Democrats in polling and self-declared have said that they prefer to do mail-in ballots than Republicans. So it's going to start out with an edge. But if it's an edge for Biden that is so large and so insurmountable, it's going to be really, really important for Biden to build that in those mail-in ballots so that he can hold off any losses that he'll see on Election Day. But again, I would, you know, hesitate to make any declarations just based off of those mail-in ballots that we're going to get, mail-in and early voting that we're going to get right when the polls close, so that we can get a sense from some of the experts on the ground as to how much, you know, Biden needs to build that lead in order to hold off Donald Trump, who's expected to see a surge on Election Day.
Based on some of what you've said in our conversation today, it doesn't sound like it should be so close as a 3% margin in the polls that the latest New York Times Siena College poll reflects, and that's pretty consistent with other recent polls, about 3%, which is small and really within the margin of error of most polls. So maybe we should call it a statistical tie. You were describing a 20-point swing compared to a decade ago in white college-educated voters, likely to go for Biden so many points more than they did even for Obama. You described rising African-American turnout, rising Latino turnout, people disenchanted by Trump's approach to the virus in their state. Why is it close?
Well, because we ultimately don't actually know if we're going to see African-American and Latino turnout hit the totals that Democrats need. Look, I said that those were critical and that they're hitting an early voting just below where they need to be, you know, or compared to 2008. But that number has sort of steadily ticked down as early voting has gone on. And that number could get overwhelmed. You know, look, we're still waiting to see how Republicans perform on Election Day. But we've also seen in early voting, as that has gone on, that the sort of the composition of who has shown up is much more reflective of the state at large, which is about a third registered Republican, a third registered Democrat, and a third registered unaffiliated. And so the hard thing is, and why it's hard to make these predictions, even though we do have clues from public polling, obviously we have modeling and a sense of modeling from inside the campaigns themselves, we don't know ultimately how those unaffiliated voters are necessarily going to break. And that's a key constituency. Some of those are certainly those college-educated voters that we talked about that are now moving into the suburban areas. But that's not necessarily a guarantee that they're going to either show up in the numbers that Biden needs or that they're going to break for Biden over Trump. And so, I realize there's a little bit of PTSD coming from 2016 of not wanting to sort of overinterpret, overread the polls, overread this data before we actually know what the full data set is, because we don't have it yet. So I think that it's important to sort of still see this as a close state. As you said, in public polling, it's been locked within a margin of error. And even though Biden has been consistently on top, you know, I'm not ready to go far from declaring victory. Let's just put it that way.
Elena Schneider, national political correspondent for Politico, on one of the key swing states to watch that we might have a very early, as their polls close at 7:30, indication of on election night, and a lot of early votes being tabulated now and to be announced at that time. I'll be anchoring in that 7 o'clock hour, a national election coverage special here on WNYC on election night. So we will see, and we will be on it. Elena Schneider, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.